This is special coverage on the Park Fire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. It's been 8 days since the Park Fire started in Upper Bidwell Park in Chico. The fire has burned more than 3 times the surface area of Lake Tahoe in Butte and Tehama counties. The fire is still most active on its north end, and today firefighters are bracing for weather conditions that could make firefighting even more challenging for the next few days. Crews are already working in rugged terrain filled with steep drainages. Now temperatures are also increasing to the triple digits, daytime relative humidity is dropping to the teens, and drier winds out of the south are expected to increase. All combined to create challenging fire weather conditions. On top of that, there's concern about thunderstorms tomorrow and over the weekend, which could cause new fires. Officials are asking residents to stay alert and continue to be ready to evacuate. This continuous need to stay aware and be ready to go in communities across a large swath of the North State this past week has been a sort of signature of this fire. The Park Fire spread quickly, it's taken a pause, and even threatened areas again after it was thought it might have moved on. But this stop-and-go pattern is reminiscent of another fire we saw here just 3 years ago.
I think it's really interesting to look at the parallels between the Park Fire and the Dixie Fire. What we saw in the Dixie Fire is that the Dixie Fire started in the middle of July, and it grew kind of explosively for a week, and then it kind of laid down for about a week. And then in the beginning of August, it went on this enormous kind of rampage and burned from down around Butte Meadows all the way up to Juniper Lake in a matter of a couple of days.
That's Zeke Lunder. He's a longtime fire analyst and founder of the wildfire information website, The Lookout. He says the Park Fire started off very similarly to the Dixie. It started in the middle of July, made a huge run at the start, but then has been fairly dormant.
And so I'd say definitely any change in the weather and in the stability of the atmosphere is a major watch out, because we've got so much fire on the ground on the north flanks of the fire.
Today we'll hear a conversation with Lunder and host of Blue Dot at NSPR, Dave Schloem. They'll talk about the geography of the North State and its connection to wildfire, misconceptions about firefighting, and lessons learned from the Dixie Fire. The conversation starts in Chico, where the Park Fire started a little more than a week ago.
We had a kind of an odd southeast wind, and the fire started in Bidwell Park fairly early in the afternoon. And one of the things about fire is that it has different kind of windows of opportunity to become large. But if you look at the kind of entire day, we have kind of what we call the active burning period, which goes from about 2 p.m. till about sundown. And before that, you know, you've got kind of typically the temperature comes down overnight and the humidity comes up, and the fine fuels like grasses, they recover some of the moisture that they've lost during the heat of the day. So in the morning, if the humidity is 60%, a lot of the grass, the fuel moisture comes up to a point where it'll barely burn. And it takes a while for the sun to kind of evaporate the moisture out of the dead vegetation. So that early morning period, usually there's kind of a lag before the vegetation is really fully primed to burn. And so in the afternoon, you've got the direct sun, the moisture is gone from the vegetation. We often get some winds in the afternoon. And so we call that the burning period, you know, early afternoon to sundown. And that's the time that fires can spread best. So anytime you've got a fire start that starts, you know, around 2 o'clock, it's kind of a bad thing right off the bat, because it means that the fire potentially has, you know, 6 or 7 hours of active burning available to it. If you have a fire that starts at 10 in the morning, oftentimes you'll put it out because the fuels aren't critically dry. And if you have a fire that starts at 5 p.m., oftentimes it'll only burn for a couple of hours before the sun goes down. So that was the first thing that really gave this fire an opportunity, was that it started on a windy day early in the afternoon, and it started in a place where it had immediately access to run up a slope that had wind blowing on it. So we talk about that being alignment, where the slope and wind and fuels and fire location are all kind of in the perfect setup for the fire to run up the hill with the wind at its back. So right off the bat, the fire had an alignment. It ran up out of Bidwell Park. And if you've walked in Bidwell Park and up the North Rim, you know that you can't really like drive a fire engine up the North Rim very fast. And so like maybe 1 mile an hour, 2 miles an hour. So it takes a long time to get, you know, the mile from the North Rim parking lot up to where the fire is. You can't get there in a fire engine in time to catch a fire that started at the bottom and got to the top in 10 minutes. So right off the bat, the firefighters had access issues. they kind of painted the sides of the fire with air tankers, and the fire kind of raced about a mile an hour towards Richardson Springs. And what we have around here is this kind of transition that goes from grass and blue oaks to live oak and gray pine. And as you increase in elevation, you get more vegetation. You know, Chico proper only has like 15 inches of rain a year. And Forest Ranch, which is 13 miles up the hill, they have 60 inches. So there's this kind of linear relationship between elevation and precipitation. And that added precipitation causes more soil weathering. And so the soil gets better and better as you get higher and higher up the hill. So by the time the fire was getting towards Richardson Springs, it was getting into heavier vegetation that includes thickets of live oak and gray pine, and also manzanita. So the highly flammable, well aerated mix of pine needles draped in dry brush, it creates this really unique fuel cocktail. And it kind of transitioned from being a fire that was driven by wind in grass under sparse oak to a fire that was driven by heat and long range spotting. So it became apparent pretty quickly that this fire was going to make a huge run. And it jumped Cohasset Road. And in that first, 5 or 6 hours, it burned about 30,000 acres.
One of the things that I think we need to also talk about, though, on a positive note, is that fire is, not necessarily a bad thing. That this area probably really did need to burn ecologically. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, if you look at the fire history maps, there's been a really rich fire history in the Lassen foothills, and most of the species out there, the blue oak and the gray pine and the live oak, the brush species, the different ceanothus, they're all adapted to frequent fire, and they're all adapted even to high severity fire. And so blue oak that looked like they were killed after the last park fire we had in, 2021, they'll sprout back from the crowns, and the live oak will sprout back from the base, and the bay will sprout back from the base. And so most of the California species are resilient in the face of fire. And this entire landscape, this Ishii Wilderness and Lassen Foothills, almost all of it has kind of got a fire debt at this point, in large part because we've gotten better and better at putting out small fires. These major investments that Cal Fire's made in very large air tankers that can drop 8,000 gallons of retardant, those are really effective in this country when you just have like one fire and it's not critically dry. So as we've gotten better and better at suppression, we've increased the fire debt, I would say, in this landscape. And so we haven't had a large fire in this country since about 1999.
Yeah, it's incredible to think about all the fuel buildup up there. I've been up in that region, and it's just, you could tell it was primed to burn, and here it goes. Okay, so ecologically, though, that region burning is really, in the long run, not a bad thing. But what about the places where above that, where you start to get into the more conifer forests and in those areas managed by like Sierra Pacific Industries, that's kind of a different story up there. Could you describe that for us?
Yeah, I think it'll be useful for your viewers if they are interested in visualizing this to maybe open up like Google Maps or Google Earth and search for like Butte Meadows or Shingletown. And they will be able to see kind of this really amazing patchwork of clear cuts across the entire kind of midriff of the Sierra Nevada. So Sierra Pacific Industries, they're the largest private landowner, I think, in the country. They have about 2 million acres. They're the largest timber landowner in California. And they're kind of consolidated a lot of the big kind of railroad ownership. So, a lot of the private land that exists in kind of timber country in California and across the West was originally land grants to railroads in payment for them building the railroads. And so they kind of created a checkerboard where every other square mile section along the railroad corridor would be kind of given to the railroad in exchange for building the railroad into the country. And so those ownerships have kind of over years transitioned from companies like Southern Pacific and Burlington Northern and all the big original railroad builders to companies like Georgia Pacific or Louisiana Pacific or Michigan Cal or Weyerhaeuser. So in California, SPI really consolidated a lot of ownership around the time that the spotted owl crisis shut down the timber industry on public lands. Red Emerson, who owned SPI, saw the writing on the wall that the logs were going to stop flowing off of the public lands. Back in the 80s, about 50% of the logs that fed mills in Northern California came from public lands and timber sales in the national forest. So when the public lands logging got shut down in the early 90s, Emerson saw that this was happening, and he really leveraged every asset that he had, and he bought as much timberland as possible. And so they acquired companies like Michigan Cow and other major landowners, and became really this kind of the titans of California timber. So that land that they acquired was, for the most part, highly productive, like Forest Ranch, Antelope Creek, some of these places that have been threatened by this fire or burned, have some of the highest kind of site class, which is the forestry term for kind of soil productivity, anywhere in the world. So over the course of my career, they wrote a sustained yield plan that was approved by the state to do what they're doing now, that was approved in the kind of mid-90s. And then they started clear cutting. And so before they kind of took over, all of this landscape had been, for the most part, managed with selective logging, where they came in periodically and took, you know, the biggest trees off of each acre and built roads everywhere and had good access. And so they didn't clear cut. And so what SPI inherited, and I think they probably got a pretty good deal on a lot of this land, was a lot of land that had just been kind of loved to death, is what a forester would say. Just stunted, kind of overcrowded growth because of the competition and lack of fire. So SPI's strategy was basically, hey, we're going to buy this land. We're going to clear cut it over the next 60 to 80 years. And we're going to replant with the best genetics we can find for each region. So when you look at that aerial view and you see that this landscape is kind of 50% clear cuts, that's because we're like 30 years into a 60-year rotation. So, you know, 30 years from now, if they still have trees that haven't burnt, their whole landscape will have been cut over once. But that's really what sustained yield forestry looks like. So what that's kind of set up, though, is a landscape that's highly susceptible to fire damage, because young trees are susceptible to being killed by fires. And so if your whole landscape is covered with trees that are, you know, less than 100 feet tall, they're all of them are exposed to being killed by a fire. And what we had here historically before we cut all the big trees down was a landscape dominated by large trees with thick bark and maybe not even any branches for the first 50 feet. And so it's kind of, we can't really go back to that. So SPI is kind of just along, they're along for the ride, but the stage was set for this particular fire, maybe even in like the 1920s. There was a big fire in Antelope Creek in the 1920s that killed a lot of the forest that was there. And even at that time, that fire was probably driven by slash from the first logging. And so a lot of the trees in this area that are burning are all the same age. Maybe the oldest trees are 100 years old.
You're listening to special coverage on the Park Fire from North State Public Radio. We'll return in just a minute with more from fire analyst and founder of the wildfire information website, The Lookout, Zeke Lunder. Stay tuned. This is special coverage on the Park Fire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Today we're hearing from Zeke Lunder. He's a fire analyst and founder of the wildfire information website, The Lookout. He recently spoke with host of Blue Dot at NSPR, Dave Schloem, about what we've seen so far with the Park Fire, lessons we can learn from past fires, and misconceptions about firefighting.
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that if we fail to corral a fire-like park, that there's some sort of rational reason for that, that, you know, someone did something wrong, or, you know, like early on in this fire, someone made a comment on my Instagram or on my YouTube saying, oh, this is because the Forest Service doesn't allow dozers in the wilderness, or because you can't use retardant in the wilderness. And at this point, the fire had already, you know, was already done chewing up the issue wilderness and marching on. And so I think there's kind of this misconception that, like, hey, if only we'd had more air tankers available, we would have put this out. Or if only the Forest Service wasn't so lily-livered and willing to fight fire direct, we wouldn't have these huge fires. So there's these misconceptions about kind of the physical reality of what's possible in firefighting, and also kind of the timelines. You know, and I think people don't realize that, like, when this fire ran 30,000 acres in the first day, it opened up 50 miles of perimeter. And then when it was 100,000 acres the next day, it had, you know, 100 miles of perimeter. And that there's kind of this explanation, there's kind of an exponential relationship between area and perimeter. And so if you've got a fire that has 100 miles of perimeter and you've got 2,000 firefighters, that's only 20 firefighters per mile. And so there's this enormous amount of work to contain a fire. And so at some point, it doesn't matter how many resources you have available. It's not physically possible to kind of keep ahead of a fire this size that's still spreading.
You know, a lot of people, especially if they're not familiar with this area, the topography here is incredibly rugged and steep. Could you talk a bit about how fire responds in topography like we have here in Northern California?
Yeah, well, there's some interesting things it does for the fire effects. And I think it's useful to think about, like, this fire being 400,000 acres. It's got a lot of different unique vegetation types within that perimeter. So you go from, you know, kind of just right down at the base of the valley, it's so harsh and hot and dry that the only thing that can grow is grass. And then you start to get just a little bit of moisture and you have blue oak, and the blue oak kind of creates a little bit different character to the grassland. And then you get a little farther up and you got more moisture and you got live oak, and on and on and on until you get up to, you know, Butte Meadows, and you've got mixed conifer and cedar and Doug fir and ponderosa pine, and you get higher and you're in white fir and you're in red fir. So this terrain that runs through all of this, it kind of compartmentalizes the fire behavior, and it provides for a wide variety of fire effects. So, you know, with fire effects, we kind of talk about the different kinds of fire spread, where you've got head fire is the part of the fire that's most active and burning kind of away from the wind or up the hill. And you've got backing fire, where the fire is kind of moving into the wind slowly or kind of slowly backing down a hill. And then you've got flanking fire, and the flanking fire is kind of moving out to the sides of the fire. And so they, each of those kind of have their own energy output, with the head fire usually being kind of the highest output or the highest intensity. But also, the longer the fire lingers in a place, the kind of the more severe or more impactful its effects are. So we've been doing a lot of prescribed fire in Bidwell Park, burning star thistle. And you kind of develop a firing plan of looking at the wind and the terrain and the fuels, and you figure out, how can we light this fire in a way that is controllable, but also that gives us the fire effects that we want? And so what we found burning star thistle is that if we, you know, we can kind of create like a fire line on the downwind side, and we can light along that and then kind of light strips off of that until maybe it's 100 feet wide. So now we've got a fire line and we've got 100 feet of black grass. And at that point, we could go to the other end of the unit and we could just light over there, and we could let a head fire run across the whole thing, and it'll hit our black line and it'll go out. So that's the efficient way to burn it. But if we do that, the fire flashes through the star thistle so quickly that there, the heat doesn't stay long enough to steam the seeds inside of the seed head. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to get those star thistle seed heads hot enough that it steams and kills the seed. So if we light a backing fire, if we just light at the downwind side and let the fire back slowly into the wind, it takes a lot longer, but the heat lasts longer. And so it backs into the grass falls over, grass stem by grass stem, star thistle plant by star thistle plant, they fall over like little soldiers. And then the fire backs through there and it just slowly cooks through, but it, you get a lot more heat residence time on those seed heads. And that takes too long. You know, we want to get this done, and the longer that your fire is burning, kind of the more risk that there's going to be a wind or something. So in between is flanking fire, where we might establish a kind of a nice black strip on the downwind side, and then we'll send lighters, maybe walking 50 feet apart from each other, walking straight into the wind, dragging fire behind them. And the fire behind them kind of opens like a zipper. And that flanking fire is kind of just the right amount of residence time to get the project done in a timely fashion. And it gives us more heat residence time than a head fire. So all these kind of, this kind of a great learning laboratory for things like this that happen on a landscape scale. So right now the fire, the topography of this fire is that we're having these kind of head fire runs up out of Mill Creek and Deer Creek in these really inaccessible areas. And so a portion of the fire is this intense kind of dragon's breath that goes up the hill. And those fires are intense because the heat rising ahead of the fire preheats the fuel ahead of it. But that same fire that ran up the hill, then it kind of flanks slowly across the slope. And then, you know, some old stump burns or a log on the ground burns for a couple hours and it rolls down the hill. And sometimes those things will roll half a mile on the steep ground. And so then that starts a little head fire and you get another little finger of head fire that runs back up into the main fire. And then that flanks off of itself and then repeat. So in these steep canyons, the topography kind of sets up this slow motion. It's not like the fire just kind of burns straight up the canyon and it devastates everything with the same effect. We get this real mosaic of fire effects. And so the terrain, especially in places where there's taller trees that have survived previous fires, it creates a real, what we call the mosaic. And so that's one of the things that's happening now with the Park Fire. The Park Fire kind of really raged with a fairly even intensity through the grasslands and kind of the chaparral. But now that it's in the canyons, it's going to unfold over the course of days, if not more. And you think of that fire burning, like we talked about, in the 2 to 5 p.m., 2 to 7 p.m. window. Like yesterday, I flew from Missouri to California yesterday, and when I got around Carson City, I could see the smoke from this fire, and I could see like a little kind of white cap, not a huge column. And then we got to Sac, and I could see, you know, a pretty decent column. And then that was over. And so looking at the infrared, then I saw like, okay, the fire, you know, ran like 5,000 acres in, or 3,000 acres or something in the South Fork of Antelope Creek. But now it's laid down for a while. So, right. So we got this maybe 2 or 3,000 acre chunk there of high severity fire that happened with a column on it. And now for days, maybe the fire is kind of backing and the fire that got established there is going to have a really wide range of effects. So the type of landscape defines really the potential fire effects. So the terrain and topography around here and any place you go, the fire ecology, the fire effects are baked into that landscape.
I'm curious about, we had this huge fire just a few years ago in 2021, the Dixie Fire, which was just truly massive and very similar, has some similarities to this fire. I'm wondering, what are some of the similarities and differences, and what are some of the lessons, like for you in particular, that you learned studying the Dixie Fire that you see playing out with this one?
I think the lesson for me, a big lesson with the Dixie Fire, is just that there's these real limits to kind of our Western science approach to understanding potential of fire behavior. And that a lot of the kind of what we consider to be gospel around fire and fuels management really doesn't exist. So we thought that if you thin the forest to a certain spacing, that a surface fire would transition, a surface fire would no longer be able to become a crown fire. And so, you know, before the Dixie Fire, I did a lot of work in the Elmanor Basin modeling potential fire behavior. With the aim of kind of identifying high priority areas for prescribed fire and thinning. And then when the Dixie Fire happened, like it didn't behave anything like our modeling said it would. Like our modeling was basically garbage in that it totally underestimated the potential for massive crown fire run. So like what we saw burn around Chester and Juniper Lake during the Dixie Fire, like there was no way to get the models to predict that. And another thing I think about the Dixie Fire is just that it was such a long drawn out affair. And so coming into this fire, there's kind of this part of me that has kind of like got this cautionary feeling that like, okay, well, this fire, it's not going to be controlled this week and it might be burning a month from now. With the Dixie Fire, you know, another similarity is the Dixie Fire took off in the middle of July and grew quickly. And then it kind of laid down for about a week and then is off to the races again for all of August. So as this fire here is laid down for the last couple of days, I kind of just have this feeling that like I'm waiting for the shoe to drop. I'm waiting for that kind of wild frontal passage that where we see this fire like burn up and over Turner Mountain in a single day. It's just kind of camped out right now. The fire's kind of camped out low on the slope of this pretty massive mountain and not doing much, but there's this potential and you just know it's there, that like subtle changes can have major effects on fire behavior. You know, so, and that's one of the reasons that climate change is impacting fire behavior so much, is that, you know, or I'd say less impacting fire behavior and more impacting firefighting techniques. And one of the big lessons from Dixie was that if you don't have cool nighttime temperatures and good relative humidity recoveries, you can't pull off large-scale firing operations. And so on this fire, there's been kind of a window of opportunity that arose, I think around Saturday, where Cal Fire's pulled off a really amazing firing operation on Highway 32, basically from where Highway 32 comes out of Deer Creek at the K line. They fired from there all the way back to the Butte Meadows turnoff at Lomo. So pretty much the entire Upper Chico Creek watershed as transected by Highway 32, Cal Fire was able to put fire on the ground there for miles and miles and hold it. And huge, huge tactical win. But if we hadn't had a change in the weather and, you know, temperatures have dropped like 20 degrees during that time period, the humidities have been better at night. If we hadn't had that, they wouldn't have been able to hold the fire there. It would have gone right over the top of Colby Mountain and burnt Butte Meadows, and it might, you know, have eventually come back down towards Paradise.
That was Zeke Lunder, fire analyst and founder of The Lookout. He recently spoke with the host of Blue Dot at NSPR, Dave Shlom. You can find The Lookout at the-lookout.org. And that is our special coverage for today. We'll continue to monitor this fire and bring you any new information during All Things Considered. If you missed any of our special coverage from earlier this week, you can find it on our website, mynspr.org, or by getting our Headlines podcast. Find it on the NPR app or wherever you get your podcasts. Matt Fidler and Dave Shlom produced this special coverage. Matt is also our technical producer. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to North State Public Radio.